Okay, today we're going to try and discuss why kashrut. What does it do to us spiritually? And what I might say might be a bit controversial. Let me just recap briefly over what we discussed last week. And we gave a few reasons for kashrut. And we said that number one reason is to cause revulsion of the shedding of blood. We find this in last week's Torah portion when God talks to Noah. And he tells Noah, one of the laws he gave to Noah was different debate. There's a debate between Rashi and the other commentaries. Rashi says the law was that a person is not allowed to eat the limb of a living animal. Not allowed to cut off a limb and eat it. The other commentaries say no. Ramban, Nachmanides says it was a law of not drinking blood. So seven Noahide laws which we talk about as applying to all the world, not just to the Jews. One of the laws might be not eating blood. So the idea of kashrut is to cause revulsion at blood. Seeing blood should make a person revolt. And that's one stage away from killing people, obviously. If I feel revulsion at animal blood, how much more so I'm going to feel revulsion at human blood? And unfortunately today, if you watch the TV and the movies, human blood is cheap. Every second, it says that by the time a child reaches the age of 18, they've seen 18,000 murders on TV. Whereas we as Jews should say, you know what? We're revolted by the sight of this. This makes us sick. We can't even eat the animal's blood. We are revolted by the sight of the animal's blood. How much more so by the sight of human blood? And we talked about that last week. And we said there's a French psychologist who says that why the Jews seemingly so merciful compared with the rest of the world? Why the Jews were always the people who were acted upon rather than the ones who were acting upon others? Why were the Jews always the one who were downtrodden as opposed to downtrodding others? Look at today, look what's going on in Israel and the Palestinians. Which other nation, where do you find a concept in the world of land for peace? All of a sudden when it comes to Israel, there's a concept the world has of land for peace. Nowhere else. United Nations, not talking about any other nation in the world where it talks about land for peace. You have to give to get peace. There's no such thing. The world doesn't understand. There's no concept like that. But when it comes to the Jews, give. Give. The world expects the Jews to give. So a French psychologist asked the question, how come people have killed the Jews through the ages? Millions of Jews have been killed through the ages. And the persecutions and the pogroms, when Nazis, millions of Jews have been killed. How come the Jews don't kill? Where's our vengeance? Where's our vengeful streak? If we really had a vengeful streak, we'd want to kill all the Germans. And here we are, the Jews, driving BMWs and Mercedes. It's an irony. So he says an interesting thing. He says, our mothers in those days, if you wanted to eat chicken, you had free-ranging chicken in the backyard. He says, our mothers, when they wanted to eat chicken, would take the chicken in the backyard and wring its neck in front of all the children. All the children are watching. They're learning how to kill at a very young age. We Jews are not allowed to do that. We have to take the meat to the shochet. So that's the first reason is to cause revulsion, the shedding of blood. Today it's very easy. Today you go to the supermarket. Everyone goes to the supermarket. But amongst the Jews, that was the case all the time. You couldn't kill the animal yourself. You had to take it to a rabbi. The rabbi would kill it. Why? Because we don't know how to control our impulses. Once we start shedding blood, there's no end to whose blood we're going to shed. The second reason is to limit the number of animals a Jew is permitted to kill and eat. We're limited. We cannot. Today, how many animals are getting extinct today? How many wild animals are extinct? Why? Because they've been hunted out. We are not allowed to hunt. Imagine, a Jew is not allowed to hunt. We are not allowed to hunt. We're only allowed to kill for food or for some other use. Someone asked me today about minks. Are Jews allowed to wear minks? And the answer is, it depends on how they were killed. If they were killed in a humane way, okay, you're allowed to use the then there's a purpose to it. If they're killed in an inhumane way, we're not allowed to. Why? We're not allowed to encourage an inhumane practice. So we're encouraging an inhumane practice. So kashrut limits the number of animals we're allowed to eat. We're limited to domesticated animals, which are easily raised and easily reared and easily rejuvenate themselves. That's the animals we're limited to. The third reason is, if we look at the laws of kashrut, there are five basic laws to the laws of shechita. Five different kinds of things which make slaughtering an animal not kosher during the act of shechita. One of them is delay. I cut and I stop. And the animal's in pain. That makes the own animal pasul. That animal cannot be eaten by a Jew. It's got to be a continuous motion. Secondly, there's no force downwards. It's got to be a horizontal force. If it's a chopping force, that animal is not kosher. All these things were done. In Jewish law, an animal is not allowed to see the suffering of another animal. We're not allowed to slaughter one animal in front of another animal. All these things are done to render the slaughter of animals as painless as possible. The fourth reason is, we said, to instill self-discipline. Not of the laws of the Torah. What are they for? You can do this, you can't do this. You can do this, you can't do this. We're trying to teach a child discipline from an early age. We're trying to teach humans. It's something which is lacking today. In today's day and age, people don't know how to control themselves, their own desires. We can't control ourselves. Pirkei Avot tells us, who is a mighty person? No, it's not how many muscles you have. It's not how much time you spend in the gym. It's a person who can control their own impulses. A person who has a desire and says, you know what? I'm going to hold myself back. That's a mighty person. But a person who can't control their own desires, it's no use. You're not mighty. You're a wimp. You can't control yourself. You may rule other people. You may be a biggest dictator like Hitler. He may have been the biggest dictator, but he couldn't control his smallest impulses. You want to eat? I'll eat. I want this? I'll do it. I'll do this? I'll do that. Whenever I have an impulse, I'll satisfy it. That's not a mighty person. A mighty person is a person who can control themselves. And that's really the reason for all Jewish laws. All Jewish laws, the bottom line is, why are we doing this? Does God need all these things? And the answer is obviously not. God does not need anything. So why are we doing this? To educate ourselves. It's a case of behavior modification. You behave someone today, it's very common. You change someone's behavior, you'll change the way they think and the way they act. Hopefully, we're trying. The fifth reason is to help sustain Judaism and the cohesion of the Jewish community. Today we're seeing in America 50% intermarriage and assimilation. Why? What's one of the reasons for it? And the answer is it's a downward spiral. It's a downward spiral. It's a slippery slope. First, one of the biggest breaks in this law is kashrut. A person who keeps kosher, I can't eat anywhere. If I can't eat anywhere, I can only mingle in a certain society. I can't go somewhere and I don't eat there. It stops me from mingling. If it stops me from mingling, it stops me from associating. If it stops me from associating, obviously I'm not going to get intermarried. I can't eat the food. How can I get intermarried? So it's the first step. And this has kept the Jews going for many thousands of years. All of a sudden we see, we come to America, there's no kashrut. What happens? See it. The floodgates open. The cracks broaden. And that's the masses of the people are gone. So there's nothing, there's no difference between me and them. If everything is the same, I can eat the food, I can go with this, I can do that, I can do that. There's nothing to keep Judaism sustained as a cohesive community. And in fact, we said that when a Jew goes to a town, what do they look for first? A religious Jew goes to a certain town, what do they look for? They look for a kosher restaurant. You look for a kosher store. Why? Because I can't eat anything else. What does that force the person to do? It forces them to find other Jews. So really, it's a brilliant idea. The brilliant idea is, you limit someone to a specific diet, they're forced to find people who eat that same food. A person's macrobiotic, they have to find people who are likewise, they can't eat anything else. You find, if you go to Jerusalem Pizza today, you'll find there are Jews and Indians over there. Why are the Indians over there? Because they follow a similar diet, they don't want any meat in their food. So they know it's a Jewish restaurant, there's definitely not going to be meat in a dairy restaurant. So the same thing, the diet forces them to go in a certain pattern. So it helps sustain Judaism and the cohesiveness of the Jewish community, which is really a national law. It's a law to keep the Jews alike and to keep the Jews going as a race, as a people. By the way, the Jews are not a race. And we see this today. If you go to Israel especially, you'll see there are black Jews, white Jews, yellow Jews. It's the only country in the world which took Africans from Africa to set them free. Think about it. You know, they blame us for the slave trade, Farrakhan and his group. It's the only one country in the world has taken blacks out of Africa not to make them slaves. Only one country. No other country in the world has ever airlifted any blacks out of Africa to make them free. No one. So Judaism is not a race. It's a big misconception. That, you know, anti-Semitism, it's a race. Semites. Hitler was a fool in that respect. There's no such thing as Semites. There's no such thing as a race of Jews. It's more than a race. It's something inside. And if we talk about it, talk about it some other time, it's really a soul. It's really the soul of the Jewish makes them special. Hitler said something interesting. He said, if you leave one little Jewish child alive, even though there's no synagogues and there's nothing else, this little Jewish child is going to cause mischief in the world. He's going to reinvent Judaism from himself. Just leave him alone. He's got the spark inside. He's going to make him reinvent everything. The whole situation will be the same. You leave one little Jewish child alive and everything's going to come back. And the idea was, it's not something physical. It's something inherent in the Jew, the spiritual side of the Jew, which we're going to talk about tonight. The sixth idea of, we said, of kashrut was to raise the act of eating from an animal-like level to holiness. This is the idea of we all eat, we have this in common with the animals. How do we raise, how do we differentiate our act of eating between an animal act and a human act? What makes eating a human act as opposed to an animal act? So one of the things, obviously, is a blessing on the food. Animals don't bless on the food. You say a blessing on the food, automatically a person is elevating the act of eating. A person is saying, you know what? It's a spiritual act. I'm doing a spiritual act. I'm blessing God for what he gave me. I'm acknowledging who gave me this food. An animal can't do that. An animal doesn't do that. We have to try and differentiate the physical act of eating from the animal. And we do that also through the laws of kashrut, by being selective in what we eat. Animals will eat anything. In fact, that's part of the laws of kashrut we're going to talk about, is the dog. The Torah tells us, don't eat any non-kosher meat. What do you do with it? Feed it to the dogs. Why the dogs? So it says when the Jews left Egypt, the dogs didn't even bark. That's what the Torah tells us. A dog did not even bark. So we reward the dogs. We have non-kosher meat. Today we sell it. But the Torah says, you have non-kosher food, which no one's going to eat it. What do you do with it? You give it to the dogs. Let the dogs eat it. From there we learn our interesting law. The rabbis use Talmudic logic over here. Pay attention. You feed it to the dogs if it's non-kosher, which implies that the dog won't eat it, it's kosher. What does that mean? If it's not edible for a dog, it's not food anymore. If it's not food anymore, the laws of kashrut don't apply to it. Whereas if it's, someone asked me, I went to visit someone in the hospital yesterday, and they started keeping kosher, and they were asking me about toothpaste. Does toothpaste need a heksher? And the answer is no. Toothpaste is not edible, toothpaste is not food, and therefore toothpaste does not need a heksher. If a dog won't eat the toothpaste, if it's really good tasting toothpaste, maybe the dog might eat it, you never know. You're crazy dogs. But that's what we learn out from the Torah law is, don't eat the meat. What do you do? Feed it to the dog. So the dog will eat it, obviously it's still edible, it's food, and therefore you can't eat it, it's not kosher. If a dog won't eat it, it's not edible, it's not considered food. Same thing applies to chametz on Pesach. Something which is not edible by a dog is not considered chametz. So one of the ways of destroying the chametz is by pouring paraffin on it. Because then even the dog won't eat it. You pour paraffin on a loaf of bread, I assure you no dog is going to eat it, unless he's an idiot. But that's one of the definitions of food which is not food anymore. It's not edible anymore. So we learn an interesting law. You leave one line in the Torah, you'll see, what does it mean? You feed it to the dog. It's tremendous reasoning over here. If a dog's going to eat it, it's still edible food. If it's not, dog's not going to eat it, it's not edible. Therefore, the laws of kashrut do not apply to it. So things like toothpaste, you find a detergent, you find a heksher. You don't need a heksher and detergent because it's not edible. So those are basically the six different, the main ideas. Let's go through them again briefly, just to recap. Number one, to cause revulsion at the shedding of blood. Number two, to limit the number of animals we are permitted to eat and to kill. Number three, to render the slaughter of animals as painless as possible. Number four, to create self-discipline in a person. Number five, to help sustain Judaism as a nation and as a community, to help the cohesiveness of Jews. And number six, to raise the act of eating from an animal-like level to holiness. So those are the major, the reasons for kashrut. If you want to give reasons for kashrut, those are the five major reasons for kashrut. But let's go now into another level. We find that there are three strong natural instincts in man. There are three major instincts in man, which are considered the three things the Pirkei Avot tells us. Three things remove a person from this world. What are the three things that remove a person from this world? Jealousy, desire, and honor. There's a person who's jealous of others, his life is not worth living. You look over your shoulder all the time, this guy's driving a Mercedes, this guy's driving a Rolls Royce, this guy's doing this, this guy's building a big house. I assure you, you want to have peace of mind. So what happens? It removes a person from this world. Eats the person up inside. I'm not successful. This guy's more successful than me. So it depends on a person's value system. That's the first thing. The second thing is desire, which we're going to talk about, and honor. person who wants honor will never be satisfied. He always wants more honor and more honor and more honor. But one of the three strongest instincts of man is desire. And what do we have desire for? There are three major things we have desire for. Food, acquisition, and sex. Three major things which we have desire for. Sex, we talked about in a series on love and marriage. Acquisition, I'm not going to talk about. We talked about in the laws of best business ethics. And now, our topic is really food. A desire of person. If you go, I just passed Charlie Brown. You go there and you see people, they're winning. You see them through the window. And they're eating over there, and they're chatting, and they're talking, and they're eating. Mainly they're going to eat. Food becomes a very important facet of our existence. Food is very, very important. People look forward to lunch, and they look forward to dinner. It becomes a very important thing. Now, Judaism is interesting because it can't compare it to Christianity. Christianity tells the person, destroy your impulse completely. Be a monk in a monastery. Forget about sex. The Pope is not allowed to get married. The priest is not allowed to get married. It's Catholicism, the original Christianity. And food, forget about as well. In the monastery, you don't have much food. I don't know what they give them to eat, dry bread and some, I don't know what. Depends on the cook. But food is also cut out. So therefore, basically what they're telling, acquisition, forget about. Give up all your worldly possessions in the monastery. Be a monk or be a nun and that's it. Judaism doesn't say that. Judaism says all these things are good or bad. These things are tools. Everything God gave us are tools. Food, we need food. Can't do without food. We can't live without food. Food is very important. What kind of food? That's something else, which we're going to talk about. Sex is very important. A person has to, first mitzvah from the Torah, pruvu milu itaretz kivishua. It's very important to have children, to fill up the world. But immoral sex, that's forbidden. That's asur. That makes a person defiled. That defiles the person. That makes a person worse than an animal. Acquisition, similarly, Judaism does not frown on riches. In fact, Judaism always respected riches. Abraham was wealthy, Isaac was wealthy, Jacob lost his wealth and eventually regained. The Bible is very specific, tells us that Jacob became wealthy again. Joseph was very wealthy. Why does it emphasize wealth? Because wealth is very important. A person wants to be able to serve God. You have to have time to serve God. If you don't have the means to earn your own living, obviously a person's not going to have time to serve God. We're all here. We have the ability to end our work and come to class. Can you imagine a person who has so little money has to struggle 24 hours a day? Won't have time for the spiritual side to mind. So we find all these things are important. So Judaism doesn't aim at the destruction of these impulses, but it looks to control them. We're not out here to destroy anyone's impulses. We just want to control them in order, why? To sanctify them. We want to make these things holy. These are base instincts. We find a man, God created man. What's the word in Hebrew for man? Adam. What does Adam mean? From the Adama. What's Adama? Land, from the earth. And what did God do to man? He blew into man, it says, Nishmat Chayim. He blew into man the Nishama of life. The soul of life. We see there are two sides to man. There's the physical side to man, and then there's the spiritual side to man. If all we are the physical, that's not good, because we're not elevating ourselves. So what we do is, there are two sides to man. There's a constant battle, which is going on within us all the time. Good, materialism, or the spiritual. Materialism or the spiritual. And we're being pulled in two directions. Because we are two directions. We're made up of two things. Which way are we going to go? So Torah says, you know what? A soul cannot exist in this world without a body. The body can exist without a soul, up to a certain extent. But that body will never be sanctified. That body will be base. And that body can be even baser than an animal. So what do? The job of the soul is to elevate the body. The job of the body is to give the soul the ability to elevate itself. We need both. They're both partners. So that's the secret of the Bible. The whole secret of the Bible is to find a way through these laws of harnessing both in the service of God. The body-soul relationship has to be strengthened, but the soul should be the boss and not the body. And we'll talk a bit about that. So it's a wrong conception that man lives by bread alone. For that we say no, wrong. Man does not live by bread alone. Man lives by bread as well, but not by bread alone. Just by bread alone, a person may exist, but is that existence really worth something? A person may exist in a coma. A person may exist on a very base level. Eat, drink, sleep. Eat, drink, sleep, work. You know, the rabbis in the Talmud says, man, one rabbi saw a fox, and he started crying. So I said, why are you crying? He said, look, the fox has an easier life than I have. The fox eats, drinks, sleeps. I eat, drink, sleep, and I have to work as well on top of everything. So there must be a difference. What is the difference? What is the advantage? And the answer is that we have a soul as well. So food instinct is dangerous if a person goes too far. It's transfigured by the dietary laws into self-discipline. So it's no accident, the first law given to man. What was the first law ever given to man? God told Adam, there's a tree in the garden, don't eat its fruit. Really, it was a dietary law. The first law given to man is a dietary law. Why? Control the act of eating. Nor must be overlooked that in the middle of one of those parashiyot in the Torah is full of civil laws. Civil law. Mishpatim talks about all the civil laws. If someone does damages to someone else, it's interesting. Most people don't think of Jewish law as in terms of civil law. But Jewish law encompasses everything. It encompasses all facets of human existence. Nothing is left for a person to think. Jewish law doesn't cover this, does it? And the answer is wrong. Jewish law covers everything. For instance, let me give an example. What kind of car you buy is covered by different elements of Jewish law. What kind of elements of Jewish law would something innocuous like buying a car, what kind of elements? Number one, there's a mitzvah in the Torah that says, don't waste. Don't waste what? Don't waste your money. Don't waste natural resources. Laws of waste. On the other hand, there's another law which says, Ushmaratei me'od nafshatechem. Guard your souls very carefully. You've got to make sure your car you buy is safe. It's got to have good brakes. It's got to have a good bumper. It's got to be able to stop within a certain distance. All these things are regulated. All these things are Jewish law. Another small example. You go shopping. The person thinks, you know what? I'm going to a store and do nothing. Wrong. You walk into a store, according to Jewish law, especially if it's a private store belonging, and there's one owner over there, you have an obligation now. You've raised a person's expectations. You walk in, you've got to warn the person, I'm just inquiring. I may not buy anything. I'm just finding out prices right now. But if you don't warn them and you just ask questions, how much does this cost, how much does this cost, how much does this cost, you're raising the person's expectations of the owner of the store. And then when you walk out, you dash his expectations. You've wrecked his day. You may ruin his day. It says laws in Jewish law regarding every facet of human existence. And it's very hard to be 100%. No one can be 100%. We have to strive. We have the levels are there. We have to strive as do our best as we can. The same thing, right in the middle of all these civil laws, bang, the Torah tells us dietary law. It gives us dietary law. Why? What is it telling us? It tells us that the secret to civil laws, if you can't control your appetite, you're going to break civil law. Look at America. There's 2 million people in jail today, at least. What was the last count? 2 million people in jail today, and they have to build new jails. Why is that? If I can't control something so basic as what I eat, how can I control where I put my fingers? How can I control what I take, which doesn't belong to me? If I can't control what I put in my mouth, how can I control what comes out of my mouth? You think it's easier? What's easier, to control what comes in than what comes out? If you can't control what comes in, how can you control what comes out? So all this is based on control, and that's why dietary law is put bang into the middle of civil law. If you can't control what you eat, how can you control how you behave with someone else? It's very hard. So we want to teach a person control from a very early age. Very small things. So the dietary laws is the beginning of a person's arduous road to self-discipline and moral freedom, which we're going to talk about. So let's talk a bit about the mystical approach, because that's the nice topic. So according to the mystical approach, the Torah laws are a course in moral discipline, right? But the main importance is their effects are not just on us, but on the world and on the universe. Because according to the Kabbalah, we're not just over here as a unit which is separate from everything else.
According to Kabbalah, everything is part of one system. The whole universe is one system where man reacts and interacts with worlds higher than ours, which you cannot see, we cannot feel, we cannot touch. But everything we do, the rabbis explain it, if you shake a very long rope, they compare it to shaking a very long rope. You shake a very long rope, at the end of the rope, you have to shake a long, large rope. What happens? That wave you create in that rope goes all the way to the top of the rope. That's the way they compare it. Everything we do in this world has tremendous vibrations, not only in this world, in dimensions above us. And that can cause opposite and equal reactions in the worlds above, which shower us with energy. Whenever we do something good, good energy is released on us. Whenever we do something bad, bad energy is released on us. It's an equation. We're like triggers for spiritual energy. According to the Kabbalah, we're all triggers. All we do is we have the ability to trigger either good or trigger bad by our actions. So that's one idea in terms of the Kabbalah. We're going to discuss others as well. So man is viewed as a small microcosm of the universe. Talmud tells us, a person saves one life, has saved a world. Not just one life, has saved a whole world. So now we're going to talk about the effects of kashrut on the body and the soul of man. And the Torah itself expresses the view that meat of prohibited animals has a disastrous influence on the mysterious something which is the human personality. On the other hand, the Torah says, if you keep these laws, v'itkadishtem, you will become holy. V'item kadoshim, you will become holy. So on the one hand, not keeping these laws results in a disastrous result of an influence, a bad influence on a person's personality. Keeping these laws results in self-sanctification. So it makes a person easier to become holy because of the absence of debasing and defiling elements in the human body. That's really the basics of this idea. Let me just quote the pasuk. The verse says, you shall therefore separate between the clean beast and the unclean beast, between the unclean fowl and the clean fowl. And you shall not make your souls detestable by beast or by fowl, which I have set apart for you to hold unclean. And you shall be holy unto me, for I am the Lord, am holy, and have severed you from the other people, that you should be mine. This is in Leviticus 20, 25. It's in Vayikra, Sefer Vayikra 25. So we see that what? The reason the Bible gives for the kashrut laws, not hygiene. Nothing to do with the hygiene. Physical health may be one of the effects of it, but it's not a direct reason given in the Torah. As far as the reasons for these laws go, the reason is holiness. And on the contrary of holiness is unholiness. You keep kosher, it results in, hopefully, holiness. A person doesn't keep kosher, it results in unholiness. Obviously, there's other factors as well which are involved. What does this word unholiness mean? Tameh. It's translated in the English very badly as unclean. So obviously people over there get the impression of hygiene. If you read the Hebrew, it's nothing to do with unclean. It's nothing to do with hygiene at all. So it's inaccurate to translate tameh as unclean. The real world is, if you learn what the opposite is, kiddusha means holiness. They understand what tumah means is unholiness. So it's purity as opposed to impurity. Not uncleanliness, and it's supposed to cleanness. So the main purpose of kashrut is to make a person holy as opposed to unholy. What is unholiness? What is unholiness? We find it interesting. There's a comparison between the Torah's usage of words in the laws of kashrut, where it talks about unholiness, and the use of words when it comes to immorality. The words used are symbolic, the same. A person who is immoral is considered unholy. A person who doesn't keep the laws of kashrut is also considered unholy. They both make a person unholy. Interesting. What's the connection? Some of the forbidden animals also are unholy. What is meant by this word unholy? We find this one of the classic cases of impurity. The classic case of impurity is a dead body. It's called Avi Avot Hatuma, the father of the father of impurity. That's why we're very careful. Today, we're not so careful except for a Kohen, a priest. A Kohen is not allowed to go to a cemetery, is not allowed to touch a dead body, is not allowed to go into a room or into a house or into a place where a dead body is inside. You can't go under the same roof as a dead body. Why? Because that body is impure. It's so impure that he can't even go in the same building as that body. So let's try and find out from using this approach, what does this impurity mean? What does impurity mean? There's an interesting idea over here. What is the central, one of the central ideas of Jewish philosophy? Rambam brings down 13 principles of faith. One of the principles of faith we all know is to believe in one God. Second principle of faith is to believe that God is everywhere. God is all-powerful. God is infinite. Third principle of faith, God is Hayah Hoveh, yeah, he is, he was, and he will be. He's the same. He's never changed. He's above time. Time does not change God. But one of the 13 principles of faith is that there is a concept of reward and punishment. Every one of us, if we do good, we're going to be rewarded. If we do bad, we're going to be punished. And most people accept this at the back of their minds. Trouble is, most people think this is a physical thing. It's not. It can be here, it can be the next. Rambam brings down 13 principles of faith. One of the principles of faith we all know is to believe in one God. Second principle of faith is to believe that God is everywhere. God is all-powerful. God is infinite. Third principle of faith, God is Hayah Hoveh, yeah, he is, he was, and he will be. He's the same. He's never changed. He's above time. Time does not change God. But one of the 13 principles of faith is that there is a concept of reward and punishment. Every one of us, if we do good, we're going to be rewarded. If we do bad, we're going to be punished. And most people accept this at the back of their minds. Trouble is, most people think this is a physical thing. It's not. It can be here, it can be in the next world. There's plenty of, God can pay a person back a million times, different ways. There's many different ways God pays a person back. It can be this world, next world. It can be psychological suffering, it can be mental suffering, it can be physical, it can be anything. God picks the time and place. There's a famous Talmud, talks about Titus, the emperor of Rome, who destroyed the second temple. And when he takes his booty, including the menorah and other things from the temple, into his boat to Rome, the boat starts shaking in the river, in the sea, in the Mediterranean. And it's going to capsize. And he says, you know, God, he says, all your enemies, you killed them in the sea. Pharaoh, you killed him in the sea. Sisera, you killed him in the water. You only have power in the sea. God says, okay, go. He goes onto the dry land. And it says, God sends a mosquito to go into his brain and eat up his brain. So I don't need to. Look, God has many different agents. And also for good. God has many different agents. We believe in this principle of reward and punishment. But what does that mean? We believe in reward and punishment. You can't reward, you don't reward your computer, do you? You don't reward your microwave when it works. So what does this principle of reward and punishment lead us to? It leads us to another principle. Ever seen a guy tap his car and say, you've been a good boy today. I'm going to give you an extra polish. There's a lot of people like that, by the way. They treat their car like, animate objects. It's crazy people. And they go and polish their car religiously every Sunday. It's a religious, you got to polish your car. It's very important in today's society. It becomes a religion already, pampering the car. You see how many places are being opened now. It's the latest craze. What are they called? For cars, the clean cars. Car wash. It's not car wash. It's more than car wash. Salon. They got a car salon now. You got to religiously look after your car. It's very important. Poor car, you know. But we don't reward our computer. We don't reward our microwave. We don't reward our car usually. Why not? And the answer is the machines. You don't reward a robot. You don't reward something which doesn't have free choice. So if we have a principle of reward and punishment, that shows that we believe in something else beyond that, which is free choice. We believe in a principle of Judaism. The crux of Judaism is God created us in this world. He put us in this world with good and bad. Why did God create evil? That's one of the... If you believe in God, there's only one question you have to answer. A person doesn't believe in God, he's got a million questions. How come we have plants? How come we have animals? How come we have rainbows? How come we have air? How come we have this? How did everything evolve into this place? Why did everything evolve like this? Why didn't everything evolve into something else? A million questions. If you believe in God, you only have one question. Why does evil exist? And the answer is to give us free choice. If evil didn't exist, we would be robots, exactly as we're saying. We'd be like cars. We see God so clearly, we don't have any choice. The angels, we had a discussion once. Do angels have free choice or not? The Bible talks about fallen angels. How could an angel fall? Right at the beginning of the Bible, look at Genesis. First parasha.
It talks about angels. They came down and married women. It says the daughters of man were beautiful. The angels came down. And how can an angel come down? Angels don't have free choice. And the answer is, yes, they do. Angels have free choice. But they're so close to God, they're absorbed. They don't have free choice next to God. It's like when you have a policeman right following you, and you can see him in your rear view mirror, especially Highland Park police, you don't have any free choice left. You just take it very slow. And they'll give you a ticket for going slow and blocking traffic. But that really removes the free choice. God put us in a world where we can even forget God. It's amazing. God put us in a place where we can even deny God's presence. That's how far we removed we are from God. We're in the fourth level down, the rabbis tell us, the Kabbalists tell us. We're in the world of action. Four stages removed. We're in this sort of vacuum. A vacuum from God. God is outside, looking in. In very small quantities. But we have free choice. We have choices to do good, we have choices to do bad. So free choice is a central concept of Jewish religious philosophy. It's called moral freedom. We are all free to choose. Man is morally free. And it's a philosophical belief which is within the whole system of Judaism. Anything which endangers or weakens this conviction is therefore a deadly danger to man's inner harmony. In other words, if a person will be so overwhelmed and say, you know what, I don't even have free choice anymore, that's going to destroy that person. We find cases in the Talmud. Talmud talks one classic case. It talks about Elisha ben Abuya. Elisha ben Abuya was a great rabbi, who is the rabbi of Rabbi Meir Balanes. Rabbi Meir Balanes was, today a lot of charities in Israel are named after Rabbi Meir Balanes. He's buried on the outskirts of Tiberias. If you go on the outskirts of Tiberias, you'll see his. There's a big over there. Someone built a big. There's a nice building over there on his site, Meir Balanes. Rambam is inside Tiberias. This is on the outskirts. But just before you enter Tiberias, you'll see a big building on your left. If you go to Tiberias from Jerusalem, you'll see a big building on your left. And that's the grave, the site of Rabbi Meir Balanes, who was very, very famous. Meir Balanes had a rabbi called Elisha ben Abuya, who today is not called a rabbi. In fact, the rabbis in the Talmud do not refer to him by name. They call him Acher. Elisha ben Abuya became an apikoros, denied God. A great rabbi denied God. He had this free will to deny God. So his student, Meir Balanes, asked him, Rabbi, he says, you know so much. Do teshuva. He said, for me, there's no way of return. There's no path of return for me. Once he gave up his free will, there is no free will. It's all in our mind. Our free will is in our mind. What can destroy a person the most? What can destroy a person's free will the most? That is tumah. What is defilement? Defilement is something which can destroy your free will. What can destroy the person's free will the most? Contact with the dead. A person has contact with the dead, that can destroy their free will. How? How can that destroy your free will? We find the Romans used to have orgies. I mean, today, if you go to the American parties, they're nothing compared. You go to nothing compared to Roman parties. Thank God. I mean, I'm talking about in a good way. The worst American party can never compare to the Roman party, and before that, especially to the parties of Achashverosh. This guy knew how to throw a party. It was a 180-day party. If you read the Megillah, 180-day party. I mean, can you imagine what kind of party that was? 180 days. Today we'd have a hangover. The next day we'd go home, and we're broken. These guys were tough. 180 days. They're partying 180 days. The Romans, it says, when they partied, they put a skull on the shelf. Can you imagine partying in front of a skull? Why do they do that? They say, look, we only have a limited amount of time in this world. Let's enjoy ourselves. We'll enjoy ourselves as much as we can because we're going to be a skull soon. That's all that's going to be left of us. If that's all that's going to be left of us, let's not waste our time. Let's enjoy. That was the attitude in those days. Why? Death has that power. Death can put this thought in a person's head. That what? If we're human, we're mortal, we only have limited time. What are we going to do with that time? Enjoy time. Don't waste the time. I told my wife when I got married, I said, we're limited in our time. Why waste our time fighting? It's a waste of time. Let's enjoy it. It's true. We have to enjoy certain things. We have to enjoy. Why waste? People waste their time on doing things which are terrible. Why bother? Why waste our time arguing and fighting and harassing and... Waste the time, use the time positively. It's very important to use time positively.
But something which can ruin a person's equilibrium of free choice, one of the things which can ruin it is death. And you find this when a person's relative dies, they start thinking, what is life all about? It's just a waste. You find King Solomon, before he dies, writes a book called Qohelet, Ecclesiastes. Any person who reads that book is going to get very depressed. Because he says, vanity of vanities, everything is vanity, and everything is vanity, and everything you do under the sun is vanity. If it's so, what am I doing over here? Waste of time. Vanity. It can ruin a person's equilibrium. The Talmud says the rabbis did not want to include this book into the Bible. What's going on over here? This man is saying that the whole of life is vanity, and therefore, what's the purpose? There's no purpose. So Rabbi Akiva stood up. He said, no, let's include it in the Bible. Why? It has a good ending. Because one line, the last line, is very valuable. What does it say? Sof davar kol nishma. The end of the matter is, etay le'imira, fear God, mitzvotav shemor, and keep his commandments. King Solomon was using the opposite. It was, we're going to die, and everything we have is worth nothing, and you can't take anything with you. As someone said, there's no pockets in the shroud. You know the famous joke, it's an interesting joke. It says, a man had three friends. He had an Italian friend, and a French friend, and a Jewish friend. And he says, I don't have any relatives, so I'm going to leave each one of you $10,000 in my will. But I ask of you one favor. When I die and they're burying me, throw $200 into the grave. Just to impress the people around. So they're burying the guy, and everyone's standing around. A Frenchman comes, $200 in the grave. And the Italian comes, $200 in the grave. The Jew writes a check for $600, takes the cash, and puts the $600. But that's, we can't take everything with us. So really, it's a waste. It's a wasted. Everything is wasted. Death can damage our inner harmony of free choice. And therefore, the rabbi said, keep away from death. The Torah says, keep away from death. Death is not something we want to get into. Why? Because death might bring this question to a person's mind. What is it all for? Why am I doing all this? So that's the arch symbol of man succumbing to physical necessity and saying, you know what, there's no hope for a person. Might as well be immoral, might as well be depraved, might as well, like the Romans, might as well do anything. And that's really what Tumah is all about. Tumah is upsetting our free choices. We learn from that, that's what Tumah is all about. Defilement is upsetting the free choices. So when is a person, how can a person purify themselves? They have to go, it takes 7 days, and then they have to go through a ritual bath, and then they can purify themselves. It's called, the water is called Mayim Chayim. It's interesting. You touch death, you've got to go through a process of rebirth. Christian concept came from the Jewish concept. Going to a mikveh is like a process of rebirth. A person who goes through death has to go through a process of rebirth. Similar to the laws of Nida, same thing. Every month, a woman has a potential for life in her stomach. That egg is killed every month, dies. That potential is gone. It's like a death every month, and therefore the woman has to go to the mikveh, which is a rehealing, which is a process of rejuvenation again. So a similar idea, that this is a metaphysical idea. What are animals going to do with this? There are certain animals which can upset a person's balance of free will as well. That's what the Bible is telling us. Certain animals are tamei. Certain animals are unholy, and they can upset our moral choices. And they can defile us and lead us to other things. But the question we have is, how can food influence the spiritual life of man? Food is, after all, physical. And the soul is spiritual. So how can the physical affect the spiritual? We find, if we probe this a bit deeper, we find this difficulty is really only apparent, not really a real one. And the problem is really not only with regard to the dietary laws, it's a problem with anything we eat, not just dietary laws. And you'll see today doing research, how the diet affects human behavior. We know today there's a thing called attention deficit syndrome. And we know today there's a thing called hyperactivity. And we know today that what? What causes these things? What has a great role in these things? The food we eat. I don't want to say, I told you so. God is saying, you know, I told you so. Diet is very important. Here we are. We're just waking up now. We don't know what these things do to us. But today we're finding more and more. Some people are very allergic to different things. Allergies. That food has a tremendous influence. Not just on the physical aspects, but also on the emotional aspects. Certain things a person can eat make them depressed. We know this because there are drugs which a person can have to make them high, to make them depressed. Diet is very, we're seeing over and over again. Alcohol.
That's diet. That's part of the diet. We can see the effects of the alcohol. But how do we see the effects of things which are not as rapidly working and which are not so powerful? We can only measure their effects over time. And no one has ever done these studies. So all we have is the Bible is telling us these things have an effect. And they have a debilitating effect on our souls. What does that mean? The doctor would tell you, don't eat this because it's poison. Which fool is going to eat it? If God would tell you, don't eat this because it's poison to your soul, the question we have is, and this is true for everything, is we have to understand, number one, is when a person buys a refrigerator, a person buys a microwave, a person buys any gadget, what comes with the gadget? You get instructions. You get a manual. If we believe that God created man, and it's interesting because of the scientific evidence now, it's much more logical to say that than ever before in the history of man. It's much more logical now to say there's a creator than any time before, because we know today that everything came about by bang, one bang, everything came about. So therefore what? So the creator, there's a creator. Where's the guidebook? Where's the manual which came with the creation? How do we know how to fine-tune ourselves? When you get a car, you know, you get your instructions. Every 3,000 miles, you got to go for an oil change. Without those instructions, what's going to happen? That car's going to break down. When we were created, there's a guidebook as well. There's a manual was given. And this is the manual. And the manual tells us certain things are debilitating to the soul. The question is, what is the relationship between the body and the soul? And this is a question which the greatest philosophers from Aristotle and Plato, and even before until our own day, are busy with. And the question has been subject to a variety of different explanations. What is the relationship between the body and the soul? There's a theory of psychophysical parallelism, which means the body is going in one direction and the soul is going in the same direction. They're parallel. But as you know, where do parallel lines meet? They do. Where? In infinity. They're saying they don't. But it's the mathematical way of saying they don't. The mathematicians tell us they meet. Where? Infinity. If you keep on going, 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 keep on going. Ad infinitum. Then they'll meet somewhere. Whatever that means. That's typical mathematics. Okay, that's just hiding the problem. Hiding the issue. It's the same thing. That's what it says. Psychophysical parallelism says the body and the soul, they never meet. They're reciprocal. They're there together. They never really interact. They're there together. There's no influence from the soul on the body, and there's no influence on the body and the soul. The second view is the theory of psychophysical interaction. The body and the soul act mutually upon one another. Yes, philosophers say that. There is an interaction between the body and the soul. And we know this. What is depression if not a psychophysical interaction? You know, the body is perfectly fine. Person gets depressed, all of a sudden he has aches and pains and he's feeling sick. Psychosomatic, we have psychosomatic things today. Finally, according to the view of philosophical materialism, mind is nothing but an emanation of matter. Where does the soul come from? Soul comes from matter itself. If the soul comes from matter itself, then the soul is part of matter, and then matter affects the soul, obviously. To this very day, natural scientists don't even know what the matter is. Pardon the pun. They don't even know what matter is. They're in doubt. What is matter? If you ask them, what is matter, they'll tell you. In my day, it was electrons, protons, neutrons. Today, there's quarks, and there's this, and there's all sorts of things in matter. They don't know what matter is. They haven't got to the bottom of matter yet. And then when you get smaller and smaller, you'll find the matter is not even a particle anymore. What is matter? It's what is it? It's a force field. I don't know what it is today. You ask people what matter is, they'll tell you, I don't know what matter is. It's a secret. We haven't got to the bottom of matter. So now they're telling us the matter and the soul comes from matter, but we don't even know what matter is. Where does the soul come from? From the point of view of physiology, the question as to how food can influence mind and character hardly exists. Because we all know that food affects the mind and matter. We all know that today. You can just see it. Go and see the alcoholic drinks on the body of the person. Modern physiology admits that foods in general affect both the physical health of man and the mental health of man. So it's obvious today. Whatever a person eats affects them. In other words, the diet of the body is closely linked to the soul. If you want to see that, go and watch what you eat and see the effects of what you ate on your behavior and on your personality. So, from the religious point of view, the answer to the question how food can influence the spiritual life of man is simply this. God, who created both body and the mind of man, surely knows best what is good and what is bad for the well-being of his creatures. The Torah says explicitly that certain animals, fish and birds, have a contaminating influence on the soul of man. We, ourselves, are limited in the knowledge of the true relationship of body and soul. And therefore, who are we to deny what God says? Today, we're still doing research into the basic diet. We don't even know what's good and what's bad. If you look, every so often, there's a big debate between the dietitians. Is this cholesterol good or is this cholesterol bad? Is this fat good or is this fat bad? Every day, every couple of years, they're changing everything around. So who are we to come along and say, you know what, God is wrong as well? Let's go a bit deeper into the mystical. There's a famous Kabbalist. His name is Menachem Recanati. He was an Italian Kabbalist in the 13th century. And he has a book called Ta'amei HaMitzvot, The Reasons for the Mitzvot According to the Kabbalah. And he gives a whole analysis of the mental makeup of man and tries to show how it is influenced by food. He says the human body is the instrument of the soul and the only means by which the soul can discharge its tasks in this world. Because the soul is totally spiritual. The soul cannot interact with this world. The soul needs a body to interact with this world. The body is therefore an intermediary